We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids, a podcast series dedicated to exploring the latest advances in child and adolescent mental health research and practice. I'm Clara, an academic clinical fellow in child psychiatry, and I'm really interested in understanding and addressing the diverse mental health challenges faced by young people globally. In this series, I'm joined by renowned researchers and clinicians from around the world to discuss cutting-edge research, interventions, and best practices in child and adolescent mental health. And today I'm really excited because I have the pleasure of receiving Dr. Ariadna Albahara. She's a research associate at the University of Cambridge. She's also a bi fellow at Hayes Hall and a research associate at the Child and Adolescent Resilience and Mental Health Research Group, CHARM. And I also have the huge pleasure of receiving Dr. Amira Wadi. She is an assistant professor at the Universitas Gajah Mada in Indonesia, and she's also a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland. I'm really excited about receiving both of them because we're going to be discussing a paper that was recently published in JCPP Adventus about mental health measures among adolescents in 12 low and middle income countries. And we're also going to be talking about mental health in low and middle income countries more broadly. So without further ado, Ariadna and Amira, it's a huge pleasure to have you both here and to see you again as well. And to start, I wondered if you could share a little bit about your research journey so far and your experience in researching mental health in low and middle income countries and what brought you to the places you are at the moment.
Thank you, Clara. So hello, as Clara said, my name is Ariadna Albahara Sainz and I'm a research associate in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cambridge. And I currently work on projects related to children and young people's mental health, particularly school-based interventions. And before that, during my PhD at the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Belgium, my research focused on the association between autism and ADHD. So when I arrived at Cambridge, I had the opportunity to work on a project looking at mental health measures among adolescents in 12 and low and middle income countries. And this was a collaboration with Professors Tamsin Ford and Amy Arben, Jennifer Saxton and Sebastian Corten at Cambridge, and also with Daniel Carterfeld-Winther from UNICEF Innocenti.
I'm a medical doctor by training, but soon after starting practicing medicine, I found that, I wasn't really enjoying it. And at that time, I took several courses on research methodologies and biostatistics. So I was trying to find a position where I start as an apprentice doing research with a better mentorship compared to my medical school education. At the time, I got a position at the Center for Reproductive Health. So I started my career as a reproductive health researcher. But after I finished my master, there wasn't any reproductive health studies to manage. The only one available was what we will discuss later on, I guess, a survey, a multi-country survey called National Adolescent Mental Health Survey. I was like, okay, if that was the only available one, I'll take it, I guess. And at that time, I didn't have any expectation because I was eager to get my skills and knowledge into practice. But I guess we were adolescents once, so it wasn't really hard to, oh, this is an important stuff. Oh, this is interesting. And it got me also reflect on my experience and my mental health state. And now my focus is on adolescent mental health in Indonesia. Indonesia is one of low and middle income countries in the world. Like, we can argue one of the biggest one because we have 270 million people in Indonesia, and 18% is between 10 and 19 years old.
That's a really fascinating story. I love how, ended up being a serendipitous area for you? Like, it wasn't what you were originally aiming at first, but then you kind of fell in love with it, and now you're an assistant professor and completing a PhD in the topic. So that's really fascinating. I suppose I can resonate a lot with what you said, because I come from Brazil, and I still practice medicine. Like, I still practice as a doctor, but sometimes what I see in low and middle income countries in general, and I'm sure you see as well, is because of the distribution of the population, we have a huge population of young people. And then what happens as well is, with the increase in mental health needs, which you're going to talk about later in this podcast, there's a huge demand for service provision and for child and adolescent psychiatrists. I'm not sure if that's your experience in Indonesia as well, Amira. And then obviously, it's really important, and we need child psychiatrists to be there on the front line. But I also find that research is so impactful in those contexts as well, because we need good data to inform services, and services in these countries, not always, but often, they are less structured than compared to high income countries. So is that your experience of Indonesia as well?
Well, what we found out from NAMS, the service use in Indonesia is really, really low. And a part of my PhD is to figure out why is that. But it is low even after we broaden the definition of service use. And we asked the parents or caregivers of the adolescents about service without really defining service as a formal service, because the thought at that time was in Indonesia, it was hard to access formal service, because first, like you mentioned, like stigma, just like social barriers. And then even when parent or adolescent are willing to access service, there are limited numbers of mental health professionals, especially the ones specialized in child and adolescent. So it is really hard. So in general, the percentage, the prevalence of seeking health care for mental health problems, or for what we asked in NAMS, like for their behavioral and emotional problems, was really low in Indonesia. But in Vietnam and Kenya, it was a little bit higher. So that's a part of like the question for my PhD, like why is that? Whether it's really because of something specific to Indonesia, or maybe because of the shared cultures, practice, or beliefs in Southeast Asia region, for example, then maybe that's why people in this region don't necessarily go to seek service. Or it is something else, like, because the NAMS, the INAMS, the Indonesian NAMS data is a national number, and Indonesia is a big country. And I can argue that it is also a country with a huge disparity. So Indonesia, it could be just like, this is the average number. When we look deeper, we can see any significant difference. But yeah, that's something that I still need to answer. I will look at the region to see whether it's something due to shared belief, practice, or culture. I will also look at cross-country analysis using NAMS data, because I think that's something that related to Ari's work. When we see many data from many countries, sometimes it's hard to understand the data, because there is a certain degrees of variance in the data set, right? But with NAMS, because at a time like we worked together, everything was the same standardized, so I will look at NAMS to see whether the difference is because of the variants or not, or because of the country characteristic or not. And fortunately, with INAMS, we have district representative data as well. So I can compare the national data with the subnational data. So hopefully with that, I can understand why adolescents in Indonesia only access mental health service limitedly, quote unquote, despite what we know so far, like, you know, like conversation in social media, in the popular articles, for example, everybody talks about mental health, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, like meaning that they will actively search for help. So, well, still a big question to be answered.
And actually, your answer gives me a really nice hook to ask Gary about her paper, because you mentioned something really interesting. You talked about the variants, and in Ari's paper, which we're going to put a link to in the podcast because it's just published in JCPT Advances. So Ari, I know you looked at 12 different countries, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about the data set you used and also the literature gaps that your paper tried to address.
Sure. Yeah, so in this study, we analyzed data from the Disrupting Harm Project. So this was a project which actually focused on technology-facilitated sexual exploitation and abuse of children. And this project was conducted by ECPAC International, Interpol, and UNICEF Innocenti, and it was funded by Safe Online. So in our specific study, we used mental health questions from the Disrupting Harm Survey. And this survey was designed by UNICEF Innocenti. And it surveyed adolescents aged 12 to 17 years old and one of their caregivers across 12 countries. So these were six countries in Eastern and Southern Africa. So these were Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Tanzania, and Uganda. And then six countries in Southeast Asia. So these were Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam. So as I said, the survey included a set of mental health questions, which were the ones that we analyzed in our study. And so one of the motivations for our study is that most of the existing evidence on adolescent mental health comes from high-income countries. So there is less nationally representative data coming from low- and middle-income countries. So this is also the case for mental health disaggregated by factors such as gender and age, and also the relationship between adolescent mental health and food insecurity, which is more prevalent in these two regions, has been less explored. And so these gaps are important in the sense that understanding how mental health varies across different groups will help us identify particularly vulnerable groups. As Amira mentioned, conducting mental health across countries has some methodological challenges. So, for example, language barriers, but also differences in how subjective mental health concepts are understood and interpreted. So there's something called measurement invariance testing, which allows us to address this by assessing whether a mental health scale measures the same construct in the same way across different groups. So in our case, across different countries. But there is limited research on this. And actually, the available evidence that exists shows measurement invariance in just a few scales. So what we wanted to do in our study was to test the cross-country measurement invariance of the mental health scales that we used, that were used in the survey. Also provide country-level estimates of adolescent mental health, and then explore how mental health varied by age, gender, and food insecurity.
As you said, and Amira said before as well, I think the measurement in variance bit is so important, especially in low and middle income countries. When we think about the scales that have been validated, lots of those scales haven't been validated for those populations. So, and as Amira was saying, like, sometimes it is a real challenge to compare findings across countries. And speaking of findings, can you summarize to us like the main headline findings of the paper?
Regarding measurement invariance, so we tested measurement invariance for the two multi-item scales that we included in the survey. So this was a well-being scale, which is called the Children World Psychological Well-Being Scale, which includes six items. And then the second one was a four-item anxiety scale from the UNICEF Youth Empowerment Project. So our findings showed that measurement invariance was not supported for either of the scales across the countries included in the studies. So, for example, for the well-being scale, we did not find the metric invariance. This means that adolescents in different countries interpreted or responding to items differently. And then for the anxiety scale, we did not find configural invariance. So this means that the way anxiety was conceptualized or structured was different also across countries. So this is consistent with the literature, but it meant that we could not compare the measures across the countries. And so these were the two multi-item scales we use. We also use other single scale items, but of course we couldn't test measurement invariance for these items. And then we reported estimates, but again, this need to be cautiously interpreted due to this. However, when we explored the impact of age, gender, and food insecurity, it is true that we found results that were consistent with the literature. So the most common correlate was food insecurity. And then it seemed that the impact of gender was less important. So what we see during adolescence is that generally girls will have worse mental health than boys. But from a study published by Campbell, they showed that this gender gap was reversed in a minority of countries. And this was also the case in our results. So in a minority of countries, this gender gap was reversed. So the hypothesis is that maybe gender has less of an impact in these countries that we studied. I think these results need to be interpreted with a lot of caution, again, because of the measures used that, as you see, showed that that measurement invariance was not supported for the scales.
I find this is so fascinating because there was such a large variation among what each country reported. So, for example, I think for loneliness, it was 18.3% in Vietnam versus 70% in the Philippines. And because we know that measurement invariance, which, as Ari explained, just explaining again, because I know it's a very statsy concept, basically means that if measurement invariance is supported, it means that scale or that instrument that we're using is measuring the same underlying concept in different different populations. But what I think it's fascinating is, and it's how it's counterintuitive, right? Because you would think that if you're asking about if someone is feeling lonely, that would, you know, generate the same, you're asking the same thing, but actually you're not, because culture plays such a huge role in how we perceive things. And yeah, you have really fascinating findings. And so, Amira, you have a lot of experience in the NAMS survey. And I know NAMS also included Vietnam, and you're also involved in the Vietnamese NAMS, which is also one of the countries that Ari included in her paper. So I was just wondering, how do you make sense of these findings? Do you have any insights?
So the way NAMS work, we we had three countries, Indonesia, Vietnam, and Kenya. And each country had their own implementing partner, so to speak. I was responsible mainly for Indonesia, but we worked closely together. So everything was discussed together. And I can only nod every time, you know, like when Ari explaining her findings, because it brought me like a huge, like a whiplash of deja vu when we developing the NAMS instruments. I remember we spent hours just to discuss one question. For example, again, loneliness. We wanted to ask the adolescents, do you have a friend that you usually spend time with, talking, like sharing your experience? And then each of countries were just like, what is a friend? Like a basic question. What is a friend? Because in Indonesia, we only have one word, friend. Everyone is a friend. But in English, you have friends, peers, colleagues, acquaintance. So it's just like when we talk about friend here in English, are we asking about the same thing that we refer to in our own language? And it was, we went for hours just to discuss friend. And then also we use these five to assess the mental disorders in all countries. And I remember conduct disorder instruments was the most difficult one to back translate and then discuss together, because it was really culture based. Because when we talk about conduct disorder, we're talking about a condition when somebody were just like going against the norms, and the norms is really subjective based on the culture, right? So there was a question, have you ever trying to start a fire, for example? Like if I ask that in certain places in Indonesia, like every day, because like they still have this open, you know, like using wood for cooking. So they start fire almost every day, which is, that's not what we are asking for. So, and also, the concept about truancy, like, have you ever ditched school to the point that police got involved? And I was like, maybe United States is the only country in the world that has this concept, because like, I ditched school when I was in high school. Like I was in a gifted class, like gifted program, and I ditched school. It was like a common thing. Like sometimes like you are being teenagers, like a part rite of passage basically. But this five, which was developed by our colleagues in Columbia University in New York, was obviously really Western based. So the cultural adaptation of NAMS was really long. It was almost 2 years, because of course we also had COVID-19 at that time. So our field work got postponed because of the pandemic, which gave us more time to perfect our cultural adaptation. But it was really like a labor of love, basically. So I totally can understand Ari's hard work, and I cannot say whether we got it, because we have to do what Ari did with her data set and implement it with NAMS data set just to see whether we got it right, so to speak, quote unquote. Again, what works in Indonesia can be really different to Vietnam and Kenya. And when the result came up, one of my colleagues from Kenya was the first author for our paper on ACEs at first. And the prevalence of ACEs in Kenya based on NAMS data was really high. And then like we were just like, what's going on? Because compared to Vietnam and Indonesia, it was really, really striking. But then, like, maybe it's because we already standardized everything else, like the question, the way we asked the question to the children, and then we gave the definition. So we kind of like, oh, maybe there was something that inherent to the context, the situation. Because when we say Kenya findings were high, it was not like all places in Kenya. It's like the national data in Kenya, which is like came from like whole Kenya, right? So there, I'm assuming that Kenya is like Indonesia. There are several places where the ACEs are extremely high, but there are also some places where the ACEs may be comparable to what we found in Indonesia and Vietnam. So it's the same. Like, why only 2% of adolescents in Indonesia seek care for their emotional and behavioral problems compared to Vietnam around 6% and Kenya around 10%? There must be something. Like, that's what I'm trying to learn more. Like, what is this something that might be inherent to Indonesia context? And comparing it with other countries, hopefully I can find, you know, some low-hanging fruits that can be adapted in Indonesia, or like can be a source of mental health system improvement, for example.
This is super interesting. And you've touched on some of the challenges. So the question I was going to ask you next is basically, conducting national mental health surveys is a huge challenge, I think, anywhere in the world. And Ari and I, we work with the English National Mental Health Survey for Young People, MACYP. And we know the challenge that it is to access data and curate data. And we know that there are logistical challenges as well, because, for example, in the English mental health surveys, for the latest survey, they did online and phone interviews, so everything was fairly remote. But I know that, you know, it sometimes, because of infrastructure issues, this is not always possible. So, like, how did you guys, you know, overcame that challenge, those challenges to adapt to each country? Like, in
so basically, we did many what we call DHS. Demography and health survey. So it's like, there are before what's going on in the United States now, the Department of State, the US Aid Office, usually funded or provided technical assistance for low and middle income countries in the world, so they can have their own demography and health survey. We did that multiple times in Indonesia, and that's how we learned how to conduct population-based survey. And it's basically like a mini census. You need to be really specific with the sampling frame, because you're trying to yield a national number. In NAMS, each country has their own prerogative to develop their own sampling frame. This is again a testament of the leadership from the University of Queensland and the technical assistance from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In this survey, trust is like beyond everything. So we had like full control on how we develop our sampling frame, how we develop our survey organization, because NAMS is a enumerator assisted survey. So the trained enumerator will ask the caregiver or the adolescent about the question that we have in our instrument. And everything was standardized, of course, but like, for example, in Indonesia, because we are a big country, and it was in the middle of the downturn of the first COVID-19 before we got to the new wave in 2022. So In Indonesia, we had three waves of data collection based on the COVID status. It meant that we had to do the training also gradually because we used ODK to assist us collect the data. The data quality assurance was also tailored to the country-specific law and regulations regarding data and information security. Our colleagues in Kenya and Vietnam used a different platform, so their data was managed together simultaneously, but Indonesian law doesn't allow that. So we had to manage our data quality assurance and then transfer the data to our pool server when the data was already de-identified. So this is just like a one sample how each country still has its own, how to say it, like flexibility, independence without compromising the overall data standardization. We in Indonesia, we have one module that is not available in Kenya and Vietnam. So in Indonesia, everything is single payer insurance, a little bit like in United Kingdom. So because of that, we have that module. So you can imagine that the sequence of the module, the sequence of the interview was a little bit different for Indonesia compared to Kenya and Vietnam, for example. So yeah, it can be done only because of mutual respect. I count myself extremely lucky because I started my career surrounded by people who not just, you know, like sometimes you read this on paper, on you know, you hear this from lectures saying how you manage global partnership, for example. But I got to experience it firsthand, and I was just like, oh, this is the standard. This is the gold standard. And that's something that I try to replicate in any other multi-country projects that we're working on. And it's about to get to know your partners again, get to hear each other's side of stories, opinion, and how to come into a decision together without downplaying any other parties, which is not easy because you put together some of the most brilliant strong opinion people in one place, and you are striving for the same thing, the perfection or like the high quality, and sometimes you can really into your, you know, like your opinion because you are invested on this work. So it is something that, you know, like really something that I think I will take with me for the rest of my career because it is really incredible, and it is really reflected in our work because anything good comes out of NIMS. It's because of that mutual respect and willingness to learn from each other.
No, that's really beautiful. And I think, you know, in your answer, you also gave lots of useful learning points for other researchers from low and middle income countries who are trying to implement those big, you know, nationwide surveys in their own countries. And to wrap up, actually, I wanted to ask something to both of you. So based on your experience, you know, with your respective projects researching mental health in low and middle income countries, what would be your hope or, you know, examples of research in the child and adolescent mental health world in those contexts that you would really like to see next?
Yeah, so I think also taking into account Amira's work and the findings from our paper. So I think one important direction for future research is to develop, but also evaluate the indicators we're using, especially when we're doing cross-country research, in a way that we can better measure mental health in adolescents. I think it's particularly important in research across countries. As Amira mentioned, I think another key priority is ensuring that this research is designed and also led and implemented by, or at least in close collaboration with researchers in the based in those countries, in the countries involved. So I think like a focus in creating strong partnerships is essential for producing this kind of research so that it's contextually relevant and also culturally appropriate. So we can see the examples that Amira gave regarding the concept of friend, for example, in Indonesia. We cannot simply take one measure and implement it in another country, just assuming that it will work. So I think for me, measurement is one of the big gaps and one of the big topics we should focus on right now. Yeah.
It is really important. I remember when we developed NAMS, we really wanted to look at the internet use. We started with NAMS 2018, and the tools, the instruments was basically finished or like locked in 2019 for piloting. So at the time we were really like, okay, we wanted to assess internet use, but we couldn't do that because the pilot result was not promising. So we dropped that. But now we know that it is not internet use. It's social media use. Like, it's different thing, right? So again, measurement in different contexts and to see, and this is something that you mentioned, you wrote down in your paper, Ari, that there is a huge discrepancy in data availability between high income country and low and middle income country, despite almost 90 or maybe more than 90% of adolescents live in low and middle income countries. Of course, this is an important part. And like for me personally, coming from reproductive health background, pivot to mental health problem mental health interest, like focus. I think I count myself lucky because logistically speaking, the funding on reproductive health is really difficult right now. And it's just like the right time for me to start my career on this because the funding for mental health was considered as flourishing. But we don't know now because what's going on in the world, but at the time it was good. So I hope that we will not lose our focus because a new thing will come, and then with what's going on in the world, who knows if we will have even enough money to keep looking on these problems. So I hope that we will not lose our focus on adolescent mental health, because like I know, especially in a country like Indonesia, who's really depending on the youth to move the economy forward, it is really important to make sure that all children and adolescent and youth, young people, to have everything that they need to make sure that they can achieve their highest potential. And then in turn, will drive this country to prosperity, quote unquote.
I think both of you covered so many important points, and just to comment on something you said that I thought it was fascinating, you know, how culture is shifting. And I think, you know, this is something Ari and I work together. So when I say, oh, Ari and I, we talk about that, because sometimes like we're talking in the office and like, you know, in the UK, like this current new generation, you know, it has a completely different set of values and culture than our generation. And as you said, like, you know, sometimes the content that they see nowadays in the internet, sometimes worryingly, there is a really interesting podcast on, I think by Jane and Umar on misogyny and like the kind of content kids are getting exposed to online. But, you know, this is something that, like, didn't exist. I mean, obviously, misogyny always existed, but, like, just to say that, like, you know, those influencers that are now, you know, propagating those misogynistic views, that didn't exist. Like, I grew up about, now I'm going to sound really old, but I grew up about Instagram and Facebook. Like, that didn't exist. So I think, as you said, like, culture and, you know, the cultural references are changing so fast. To have, like, a cohort in Indonesia would be such a fantastic thing, because you would be able to track over time, right? Like, you know, changes and it would be so informative. I mean, obviously there is still value in cross section, and I'm a firm believer of stepping. Like, you know, it's hard to get funding from a cohort from the outside, but I think I absolutely agree with you 100%. Like, yeah,
and more people, more country. Should have a national data on adolescent and mental health as well, right? Because, like, again, like, right now only what? Like, maybe I can't even remember. It's my dear advisor's paper, right? I cited it many, many times, but I cannot, like, there are so many numbers. I cannot remember which one is it, but I guess, like, only 2% or 2 or 4% compared to the availability in high income countries, like, 2 digits already. So we need more countries conducting cross-sectional study. That's okay. Like, we need to start somewhere, and then we can have, like, you know, more insight on how one country will be different or same, consistent with another. That would be lovely.
Thank you so much to both of you for a lovely conversation and a lovely podcast. I've learned so many things, and I've got so many insights on the work you've both been doing, and thank you so much, you, for listening.